others readied the caravel for departure. A part of him longed to skim down from his lofty station and join in, to handle the sheets and sails aloft, to carry the last and freshest of the stores aboard, to be doing something with his hands, his feet, his body, to make him a part of the crew, part of the living organism of the ship. But that was not his role here. God had chosen him to lead, and it was in the nature of things that the captain of a ship, let alone the commander of an expedition, had to remain as aloof and unapproachable to the crew as Christ himself was to the church he headed. The people gathered at the shore and on the hills overlooking the sea were not there to cheer on his mission, Cristoforo knew. They were there because Martin Pinzon, their favorite among sailors, their hero, their darling, was taking a crew of their sons and brothers and uncles and cousins and friends out into the open ocean on a voyage of such bravery as to seem madness. Or was it of such madness as to seem bravery? It was Pinzon in whom their trust resided, Pinzon who would bring their menfolk home if anyone did at all. What was this Cristobal Colón to them, except a courtier who had wangled his way into the favor of the crown and won control by fiat of what he could never have earned through seamanship? They knew nothing of the boy Cristoforo's years haunting the docks of Genova. They knew nothing of his voyages, nothing of his studies, nothing of his plans and dreams. Above all, they had no idea that God had spoken to him on a beach in Portugal, not that many miles to the west of them. They had no idea that this voyage was already a miracle which could never have taken place were it not that it had God's favor and therefore could not fail. All was ready. The frenetic activity had settled to languor, the languor to waiting, as eyes that had before watched the work now turned to look at Colón. Watch me, thought Cristoforo. When I raise my hand, I change the world. With all their labors, not one of these other men can do that. He closed his fist. He lifted it high above his head. The people cheered as the men cast off, and the caravels slipped away from land.
Three hollow gray hemispheres formed a triangle, like three serving bowls laid out for a feast. Each was filled with equipment for the different missions that Diko, Hunapu, and Kemal would carry out. Each had a portion of the library that Manjam and his secret committee had collected and preserved. If any one of them reached the past and changed it so that the future was obliterated, then that one portion of the library would contain enough information that someday the people of the new future would be able to learn of the future that had died for them, would be able to build on their science, wonder at their stories, profit from their technologies, learn from their sorrows. It is a sad sort of feast these bowls contained, thought Tagiri, but it is the way of the world. Always something must die so that another organism can live, and now a community. A world of communities must turn their dying into a banquet of possibilities for another. Diko and Hunapu stood beside each other as they listened to the final explanation from Sa Ferreira. Kemal was by himself, listening attentively enough, but obviously not a part of what was going on. He was already gone, like a dik-dik in the jaws of a cheetah, past fear, past caring. The Christian martyrs must have looked like this, thought Tagiri, as they walked into the lion's den. It was not the look of sullen despair that Tagiri had seen on the faces of slaves being chained below decks in the ships of the Portuguese. Death is death, someone had said once to Tagiri, but she had not believed it then and did not believe it now. Kemal knows he is walking toward death, but it will mean something. It will achieve something. It is his apotheosis. It gives his life meaning. Such a death is to be not shunned, but embraced. There is an element of pride in it, yes, but it is an honorable pride, not a vain one, that glories in sacrifice that will achieve a good end. It is how we all should feel, for we all are being killed this day by these machines. Kamal feels in his heart that he will die first, but it is not so. Of all the people in the world on this day, in this hour, he will be one of only three who do not die when the switch is thrown and the cargo and passengers of these hollow hemispheres hurtle back in time. Only two people alive today have a future longer than Kamal's. And yet it was not wrong of him to relish his death. He would die surrounded by hate and rage, killed by those who did not understand what he was doing. But their hate would be a kind of honor, their rage a fitting response to his achievement. Sa was nearly finished. "From the serious to the banal," he said. "Keep all your body parts inside the sphere. Don't stand up, don't raise your hands until you can see that you have arrived."
He pointed at the wires and cables dangling from the ceiling directly over the center of each hemisphere. "Those cables that hold up the field generators will be severed by the successful generation of the field. Thus, your separation from the flow of time will have almost no duration. The field will exist, and in the moment it comes to exist, the generator will lose all power, and the field will cease to exist. You'll be aware of none of that, of course. The only thing you will know is that the generator will suddenly drop. Since no part of your body will be under the generator, I'm hoping you will not risk breaking an ankle by testing whether I'm right or not."
Diko laughed nervously. Hunapu and Kamal were impassive.
"You will be in no danger from the fall of the generator. However, it will whip the cables down with it. They are heavy, but fortunately the fall is short, and there won't be that much force in them. Still, you must be aware of the possibility of being struck with some violence by the cable. So even though you may wish to strike some gallant pose, I must beg you to assume a covered, protected position so that you do not jeopardize the success of your mission by exposing yourself to the risk of personal injury."
"Yes, yes," said Kamal. "We will curl up like infants in the uterus.
Then we're done here. Time to go."
There was only a moment's hesitation, and then the last goodbyes began. Almost in silence, Hunapu was embraced by his brothers, and Hassan and Tagiri and their son Acho held and kissed Diko for the last time. Kamal stood alone until Tagiri came also to him and kissed him lightly on the cheek, and Hassan gripped his shoulders and murmured something to him, words from the Quran, and then kissed him on the lips. Kamal climbed alone into his hemisphere. Hunapu walked with Diko to hers, and just before she climbed the ladder, he embraced her and kissed her gently. Tagiri did not hear the words that passed between them, but she knew, they all knew but did not speak of it, that Hunapu and Diko had also made a personal sacrifice, perhaps not as complete as that of Kamal, but one with its own kind of pain, its own sweet bitterness. It was possible that Kamal and Diko might see each other again, for they were both going to the island of Hispaniola. No, the island of Haiti, for it was the native name for it that would survive now. But Hunapu was going to the swamps of Chiapas in Mexico, and it was quite likely that either he or Diko would die during the long years before their paths could cross. And that was assuming that all three hemispheres would arrive. The problem of simultaneity had never been overcome. Even though the wiring had been carefully measured so that it should take exactly as long for the signal to go from the switch to the three computers
and from the computers to the three field generators, they knew that no amount of careful measurement could possibly make the signals arrive with true simultaneity. There would be some tiny but real difference in time. One of the signals would arrive first. One of the fields would exist, even if it was for just 1 nanosecond, before the others came into existence. And it was possible that because of the changes caused by the first field, the other fields would never come into being at all. The future in which they existed would have been obliterated. Thus it was determined that each of the three must act as if the other two had already failed. Each must carry out the mission with as much care as if everything depended on him or her alone, for it very well might be true. But they hoped that all three machines would work, that all three travelers would reach their separate destinations. Deco would arrive in Haiti in 1488, Kamal in 1492. Hunapu would reach Chiapas in 1475.
"There is a certain sloppiness in nature," Manjam had told them. "True precision is never achieved, is never even possible, and so everything that happens depends on a certain amount of probability, has a little leeway, a bit of room to compensate for lapses and mistakes. Genetic molecules are filled with redundancy and can cope with a certain amount of loss or damage or extra insertions. Electrons moving through their quantum shells have a certain range of unpredictability about their exact location, for all that matters is that they remain at the same distance from the nucleus. Planets wobble in their orbits and yet persist for billions of years without falling into their mother stars. So there should be room for microseconds or milliseconds or centiseconds or even deciseconds of difference between the beginnings of the three fields. But we have no way of experimenting to see just what the tolerances are. We may have far exceeded them. We may have missed by a fraction of a nanosecond. We may have been so far from success as to have made this whole venture wasted time. Who can know these things?" "Why is it," thought Tagiri, "that even though I know that within a few minutes I and my dear husband and my precious son Acho will almost certainly wink out of existence, it is Deco that I am grieving for. She is the one who will live. She is the one with the future. Yet the animal part of me, the part that feels emotion, does not comprehend my own death. It is not death when the whole world dies with you. No, the animal part of me only knows that my child is leaving me, and that is what I grieve for." She watched as Hunapu helped Deco up the ladder, then walked to his own hemisphere and climbed. And now it was Tagiri's own turn. She kissed and embraced Hassan and Acho, and then climbed her own ladder, up to the locked cage. She pressed the button to open it as Manjam and Hassan also pressed their widely separated buttons, as Deco and Hunapu and Kemal pressed the buttons on their field generators. The lock clicked, and she pushed open the door of the cage and stepped inside. "I'm in," she said. "Release your buttons, travelers." "Get in position," called Sa. Tagiri was now above the hemispheres and could see as Kamal and Deco and Hunapu curled up on top of their equipment and supplies, making sure that no part of their bodies was under the field generator or extending beyond the boundaries of the sphere that the field generator would create. "Are you ready?" called Sa. "Yes," answered Kamal at once. "Ready," said Hunapu. "I'm ready,"
said Diko.
Can you see them? Called Sa, now talking to Tagiri and to the other three watchers who were in position to see. All of them confirmed that the travelers seemed to be in a good position.
When you are ready, Tagiri, said Sa.
Tagiri hesitated only a moment. I am killing everyone, so that everyone can live, she reminded herself. They chose this, as much as anyone with imperfect understanding can ever choose. From birth, we all were fated to die. And so it is good that at least we can be sure our deaths today might bring about a good end, might make the world a better place. This litany of justification passed quickly, and again she was left with the pain that had gnawed at her for the weeks, the years of this project. For a fleeting moment, she wished that she had never joined Past Watch, rather than to face this moment, to have it be her hand that pulled the switch. Who else's hand? She asked herself. Who else should bear this responsibility if I cannot bear it? All the slaves waited for her to bring them freedom. All the unborn children of countless generations of humanity waited for her to save them from the withering death of the world. Diko waited for her to send her out into the great work of her life. She grasped the handle of the switch. I love you, she said. I love you all. She pulled it down.
Chapter 10 Arrivals. Did the Lord say that Cristoforo would be the first to see the new land? If he did, then the prophecy must be fulfilled. But if he did not, then Cristoforo could allow Rodrigo de Triana to claim credit for seeing land first. Why couldn't Cristoforo remember the exact words the Lord said? The most important moment in his life until now, and the wording escaped him completely. No mistaking it, though. In the moonlight seeping through the clouds, everyone could see the land. Sharp-eyed Rodrigo de Triana had first seen it an hour ago, at 2 in the morning, when it was nothing but a different colored shadow on the western horizon. The other sailors were gathered around him now, offering their congratulations and cheerfully reminding him of his debts, both real and imaginary. As well they should, for the first to see land had been promised a reward of 10,000 maravedis a year for life. It was enough to keep a fine household with servants. It would make de Triana a gentleman. But what was it, then, that Cristoforo had seen earlier tonight at 10 o'clock? Land must have been close then, too, scarcely 4 hours before de Triana saw it. Cristoforo had seen a light, moving up and down, as if signalling him, as if beckoning him onward. God had shown land to him, and if he was to fulfill the words of the Lord, he must lay the claim. "I'm sorry, Rodrigo," called Cristoforo from his place near the helm, "but the land you see now is surely the same land I saw at 10 o'clock." A hush fell over the company. "Don Pedro Gutierrez came to my side when I called him," said Cristoforo. "Don Pedro, what did we both see?"
"A light," said Don Pedro, "in the west, where the land now lies."
He was the king's major domo, or to put it bluntly, the king's spy. Everyone knew he was no particular friend to Colón. Yet to the common sailors, all gentlemen were conspirators against them, as it certainly seemed to them now.
"I was the one cried land before anyone," said de Triana. "You gave no sign of it, Don Cristobal."
"I admit that I doubted it," said Cristoforo. "The sea was rough, and I doubted that land could be so near. I convinced myself that it could not be land, and so I said nothing because I didn't want to raise false hopes. But Don Pedro is my witness that I did see it, and what we all see now bears out the truth of it." De Triana was outraged at what seemed to him to be plain theft. "All those hours I strained my eyes looking west,
A light in the sky isn't land. No one saw land before I did, no one.
Sanchez, the royal inspector, the king's official representative and bookkeeper on the voyage, immediately spoke up, his voice whipping sharply across the deck.
Enough of this! On the king's voyage, does anyone dare to question the word of the king's admiral?
It was a daring thing for him to say, for only if Cristoforo reached Cipangu and returned to Spain would the title Admiral of the Ocean Sea belong to him. And Cristoforo well knew that last night, when Don Pedro had affirmed that he saw the same light, Sanchez had insisted that there was no light, that there was nothing in the west. If anyone was going to cast doubt on Cristoforo's claim to first sighting, it would be Sanchez. Yet he had supported, if not Cristoforo's testimony, then his authority. That would do well enough.
Rodrigo, your eyes are indeed sharp, said Cristoforo. If someone on shore had not been casting a light, a torch, or a bonfire, I would have seen nothing. But God led my eyes to the shore by that light, and you merely confirmed what God had already shown me.
The men were silent, but Cristoforo knew that they were not content. A moment ago they had been rejoicing in the sudden enrichment of one of their own. As usual, they had seen the reward snatched out of the hands of the common man. They would assume, of course, that Cristoforo and Don Pedro lied, that they acted from greed. They could not understand that he was on God's mission, and that he knew God would give him plenty of wealth without his having to take it from a common sailor. But Cristoforo dared not fail but to fulfill the Lord's instructions in every particular. If God had ordained that he be first to lay eyes upon the far-off kingdoms of the Orient, then Cristoforo could not thwart God's will in this, not even out of sympathy for De Triana. Nor could he even share some portion of the reward with De Triana, for word would get out and people would assume that it was not Cristoforo's mercy and compassion, but rather his guilty conscience that made him give the money. His claim to have seen land must stand unassailed forever, lest the will of God be undone. As for Rodrigo de Triana, God would surely provide him with decent compensation for his loss. It would have been nice if, now that all the struggle was near fruition, God had let something be simple.
No measurements are exact. The temporal field was supposed to form a perfect sphere that exactly scoured the inside of the hemisphere, sending the passenger and his supplies back in time while leaving the metal bowl behind in the future. Instead, Hunapu found himself rocking gently in a portion of the bowl, a fragment of metal so thin that he could see leaves through the edges of it. For a moment he wondered how he could get out, for metal so thin would surely have an edge that would slice right through his skin, but then the metal shattered under the strain and fell in thin, crumbling sheets on the ground. His supplies tumbled down among the fragile shards. Hunapu got up and walked gingerly, gathering up the thin sheets carefully and making a pile of them near the base of a tree. Their biggest fear in delivering him on land was that the sphere of his temporal field would bisect a tree, causing the top half of it to drop like a battering ram onto Hunapu and his supplies. So they had put him as near the beach as they dared without running a serious risk of dropping him in the ocean. But the measurements were not exact. One large tree was not 3 meters from the edge of the field. No matter, he had missed the tree. The slight miscalculation in the size of the field had at least been in the direction of including too much rather than slicing off a portion of his equipment. And with luck, they would have come close enough to the right time frame that he would be in good time to accomplish his work before the Europeans came. It was early morning, and Hunapu's greatest danger would come from being sighted too soon. This stretch of beach had been chosen because it was rarely visited. Only if they had missed their target date by several weeks would someone be within sight of him. But he had to act as if the worst had happened. He had to be careful. Soon he had everything out of sight among the bushes. He sprayed himself again, with insect repellent, just to be sure, and began the labor of carrying everything from the shore to the hiding place he had selected among the rocks a kilometer inland. It took him most of the day. He rested then and allowed himself the luxury of pondering his future. I am here in the land of my ancestors, or at least a place near to it. There is no retreat. If I don't bring it off, I'll end up as a sacrifice to Huitzilopochtli, or perhaps some Zapotecan god. Even if Diko and Kamal made it, their target dates were years in the future from this place where I am now. I am alone in this world, and everything depends on me. Even if the others fail, I have it in my power to undo Columbus. All I have to do is to turn the Zapotecs into a great nation, link up with the Tarascans, accelerate the development of ironworking and shipbuilding, block the Tlaxcalans, and overthrow the Mexica, and prepare these people for a new ideology that does not include human sacrifice. Who couldn't do that? It had looked so easy on paper, so logical, such a simple progression from one step to the next. But now, knowing no one in this place, all alone with the most pathetic of equipment, really, which could not be replaced or repaired if it failed. Enough of that, he told himself. I still have a few hours before dark. I must find out when I have arrived. I have rendezvous to keep. Before dark, he had located the nearest Zapotec village, Atatulca. And because he had watched this village over and over again on the True Sight too, he recognized what day it was from what he saw the people doing. There had been no important error in the temporal field as far as date was concerned. He had arrived when he was supposed to, and he had the option of making himself known to this village in the morning. He winced at the thought of what he would have to do to make ready, and then walked back to his cache in the dusk. He waited for the jaguar that he had watched so many times, dropped it with a tranquilizer dart, then killed it and skinned it, so he would arrive at Atatulca wearing the skin. They would not lay hands readily upon a jaguar man, especially when he identified himself as a Maya king from the inscrutable underworld land of Xibalba. The days of Mayan greatness were long in the past, but they were well remembered all the same. The Zapotecs lived perpetually in the great shadow of the Maya civilization of centuries past. The interveners had come to Columbus dressed up in the image of the god he believed in. Hunapu would do the same. The difference was that he would have to live on with the people he was deceiving, and continue to manipulate them successfully for the rest of his life. This all had seemed like such a good idea at the time.
Cristoforo wouldn't let any of the ships sail for land until full light. It was an unknown coast, and impatient as they all were to set foot on solid earth again, there was no use in risking even one ship when there might be reefs or rocks. The daylight passage proved him right. The approaches were treacherous. And it was only by deft sailing that Cristoforo was able to guide them in to shore. Let them say that he was no sailor now, thought Cristoforo. Could Pinzon himself have done better than I just did? Yet none of the sailors seemed disposed to give him credit for his navigation. They were still sullen over the matter of the Triana's reward. Well, let them pout. There would be wealth enough for all before this voyage was done. Hadn't the Lord promised so much gold that a great fleet could not carry it all? Or was that what Cristoforo's memory had made up for the Lord to have said? Why couldn't I have been permitted to write it down when it was fresh in mind? But Cristoforo had been forbidden, and so he had to trust his memory. There was gold here, and he would bring it home. At this latitude we must surely be at the coast of Sipangu, said Cristoforo to Sanchez. Do you think so? Asked Sanchez. I can't think of a stretch of the Spanish coast where there would be no sign of human habitation. You forget the light that we saw last night, said Don Pedro. Sanchez said nothing. Have you ever seen such a lush and verdant land? Said Don Pedro. God smiles on this place, said Cristoforo. And he has delivered it into the hands of our Christian king and queen. The caravels were moving slowly for fear of running aground in uncharted shallows. As they moved closer to the luminous white beach, figures emerged from the forest shadows. Men! Cried one of the sailors. And so they obviously were, since they wore no clothing except for a string around their waists. They were dark, but not, Cristoforo thought, as dark as the Africans he had seen. And their hair was straight, not tight curled. Such men as these, said Sanchez, I have never seen before. That is because you have never been to the Indies before, said Cristoforo. Nor have I been to the moon, murmured Sanchez. Haven't you read Marco Polo? These are not Chinese because their eyes are not pinched off and slanted. There is no yellowness to their skin, nor blackness either, but rather a ruddiness that tells us they are of India. So it's not Cipangu after all, said Don Pedro. An outlying island. We have come perhaps too far north. Cipangu is to the south of here, or the southwest. We can't be sure how accurate Polo's observations were. He was no navigator. And you are? Asked Sanchez dryly. Cristoforo did not even bother to look at him with the disdain that he deserved. I said that we would reach the Orient by sailing west, senor. And here we are. We're somewhere, said Sanchez. But where this place may be on God's green earth, no man can say. By God's own sacred wounds, man, I tell you that we are in the Orient. I admire the Admiral's certainty. There it was again, that title. Admiral. Sanchez's words seemed to express doubt, and yet he gave the title that could only be given to Cristoforo if his expedition succeeded. Or did he use the title ironically? Was Cristoforo being mocked? The helmsman called to him. Do we head for land now, sir? The sea is still too rough, said Cristoforo, and you can see the waves breaking over rocks. We have to circle the island and find an opening. Sail 2 points west of south until we round the southern end of the reef, and then west. The same command was signaled to the other two caravels. The Indians on the shore waved at them, shouting something incomprehensible. Ignorant and naked. It was not appropriate for the emissary of Christian kings to make his first overtures to the poorest people of this new land. Jesuit missionaries had traveled to the far corners of the East. Someone who knew Latin would surely be sent to greet them, now that they had been sighted. About midday, now sailing northward up the western coast of the island, they found a bay that made a good entrance. By now, it was clear that this was an island so small as to be insignificant. Even the Jesuits couldn't be bothered with a place so small. So Cristoforo was reconciled to waiting another day or two before reaching someone worthy of receiving the emissaries of the king and queen. The sky had cleared, and the sun shone hot and bright as Cristoforo descended into the launch. Behind him down the ladder came Sanchez and Don Pedro, and shaky as ever, poor Rodrigo de Escobedo, the notary who had to make an official record of all deeds done in the name of their majesties. He had cut a fine figure at court, a promising young functionary, but on board ship he had quickly been reduced to a puking shadow, rushing from his cabin to the gunwale and staggering back when he had strength to rise from his bed at all. But now, of course, he had got something like sea legs, and he even ate food that didn't end up staining the sides of the caravel. But yesterday's storms had felled him again, and so it was an act of sheer courage that he could come to shore and perform the duty for which he had been sent. Cristoforo admired him enough for his silent strength that he determined that no log of his would record the fact of Escobedo's seasickness. Let him keep his dignity in history. Cristoforo noted that the launch put away from Pinzon's caravel before all the royal officials had made it down into his launch. Let Pinzon beware if he thinks he can be the first to set foot on this island. Whatever he thinks of me as a sailor, I am still the emissary of the King of Aragon and the Queen of Castile, and it would be treason for him to try to preempt me on such a mission as this. Pinzon must have realized this halfway to the beach, for his launch lay still in the water as Cristoforo's passed him and ran up onto the beach. Before the boat staggered to a stop, Cristoforo swung over the side and tramped through the water, the low breakers soaking him up to the waist and dragging at the sword at his waist. He held the royal standard high over his head as he broke from the water and strode forward on the smooth, wet sand of the beach. He walked on until he was above the tide line, and there, in the dry sand, he knelt down and kissed the earth. Then he rose to his feet and turned to see the others behind him, also kneeling, also kissing the ground as he had done. "This small island will now bear the name of the Holy Savior who led us here." Escobedo wrote on the paper he held on the small box he had carried from the caravel, "San Salvador. This land is now the property of Their Majesties King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, our sovereigns and the servants of Christ." They waited as Escobedo finished writing what Cristoforo had said. Then Cristoforo signed the deed, and so also did every other man there. None had the temerity to dare to sign above him, or to sign more than half as large as his bold signature. Only then did the natives begin to emerge from the forest. There was a large number of them, all naked, none armed, brown as tree bark. Against the vivid greens of the trees and underbrush their skin looked almost red. They walked timidly, deferently, awe obvious on their faces.
"Are they all children?" asked Escobedo.
"Children?" asked Don Pedro.
"No beards," said Escobedo.
"Our captain shaves his face, too," said Don Pedro.
"They have no whiskers at all," said Escobedo.
Sanchez, hearing them, laughed loudly.
"They're stark naked, and you look at their chins to see if they're men?"
Pinzon overheard the joke and laughed even louder, passing the story on. The natives, hearing the laughter, joined in, but they could not keep from reaching up and touching the beards of those Spaniards nearest them. It was so obvious that they had no harmful intent that the Spaniards permitted their touch, laughing and joking. Still, even though Cristoforo had no beard to attract them, they obviously recognized that he was the leader, and it was to him that the oldest of them came. Cristoforo tried several languages on him, including Latin, Spanish, Portuguese, and Genovese, to no avail. Escobedo tried Greek, and Pinzon's brother, Vicente Yáñez, tried the smattering of Moorish he had learned during his years of smuggling along the coast. "They have no language at all," said Cristoforo. Then he reached out to the gold ornament the chief wore in his ear. Without a word, the man smiled, took it out of his ear, and laid it in Cristoforo's hand. The Spaniards sighed in relief. So these natives understood things well enough, language or not. Whatever gold they had belonged to Spain.
"More of this," said Cristoforo. "Where do you dig it out of the ground?"
Met by incomprehension, Cristoforo acted it out, digging in the sand and finding the gold ornament there. Then he pointed inland. The old man shook his head vigorously and pointed out to sea, to the southwest. "The gold apparently doesn't come from this island," said Cristoforo. "But we could hardly expect a place as small and poor as this to have a gold mine, or there would have been royal officials from Sipangu here to oversee the labor of digging it." He laid the gold ornament back into the old man's hand. To the other Spaniards he said, "We'll soon see gold in such quantities as to make this a trifle." But the old man refused to keep the gold. He pressed it upon Cristoforo again. It was the clear sign he was looking for. The gold of this place was being given to him by God. No man would freely give away something so precious if God had not impelled him. Cristoforo's dream of a crusade to liberate Constantinople and then the Holy Land would be financed by the ornaments of savages. "I take this, then, in the name of my sovereign lords, the King and Queen of Spain," he said. "Now we will go in search of the place where the gold is born."
It was not the safest group of Zapotecs to run into in the forest. They were a war party, bent on finding a captive for sacrifice at the start of the rainy season. Their first thought would be that Hunapu would make a splendid victim. He was taller and stronger than any man they had ever seen before, quite suitable for an offering of exceptional value. So he had to preempt them, to appear to them as one who already belonged to the gods. In the end, he virtually had to capture them. He had been blithely confident back in Juba that his plan would work. Here, surrounded by the bird calls and whining insects of the marshy land of Chiapas, the plan seemed ludicrous, embarrassing, and painful. He would have to imitate the most savage royal sacrifice ritual anywhere that didn't actually leave the king dead. Why had the Mayas been so inventively self-abusive? Everything else was ready. He had hidden the library of the lost future in its permanent resting place and sealed the opening. He had cached the items he would need later in their weatherproof containers and memorized all the permanent landmarks that would allow him to find them again. And the items he would need now for the first year were bundled in packaging that would not look too bizarre to the eyes of the Zapotecs. He himself was naked, his body painted, his hair feathered and beaded and jeweled, to look like a Maya king after a great victory, and most important, on his head and draped down his back were the head and skin of the jaguar he had killed. He had 30 minutes before the war party from the village of Atatulco would reach this clearing. If his blood was to be fresh, he had to wait until the last minute, and now the last minute had arrived. He sighed, knelt in the soft leaf meal of the shadowed clearing, and reached for the topical anesthetic. The Mayas did this without anesthetic, he reminded himself as he applied it liberally to his penis, and then waited a few minutes for it to become numb. Then, with a hypodermic gun, he deadened the entire genital area, hoping that he would have some opportunity to reapply the anesthetic in about 4 hours, when it began to wear off. One genuine stingray needle and 5 imitation ones made of different metals. He took them one at a time in his hand, and pushed each one crosswise into the loose skin along the top of his penis. The blood flow was copious, dripping all over his legs. Stingray needle, then silver, gold, copper, bronze, and iron. Even though there was no pain, he was dizzy by the end of it. From loss of blood, he doubted it. It was almost certainly the psychological effect of perforating his own penis that made him feel faint. Being a king among the Mayas was a serious business. Could he have done this without anesthetic? Hunapu doubted it, saluting his ancestors even as he shuddered at their barbarism. When the hunting party trotted silently into the clearing, Hunapu stood in a shaft of light. The high-intensity lamp pointing upward between his legs caused the metal spines to glint and shimmer with the trembling of his body. As he had hoped, their eyes went right to where the blood still trickled down his thighs and dripped from the tip of his penis. They also took in his body paint, and just as he had expected, they seemed to recognize at once the significance of his appearance. They prostrated themselves. "I am one Hunapu," he said in Maya. Then he repeated himself in Zapotecan. "I am one Hunapu. I come from Xibalba to you, dogs of Atatulco. I have decided that you will no longer be dogs but men. If you obey me, you and all who speak the language of the Zapotec will be masters of this land. No longer will your sons go up to the altar of Huitzilopochtli, for I will break the back of the Mexica. I will tear out the heart of the Tlaxcala, and your ships will touch the shores of all the islands of the world." The men lying on the ground began to tremble and moan. "I command you to tell me why you are afraid, foolish dogs."
"Huitzilopochtli is a terrible god," cried one of them.
Yax, his name was. Hunapu knew them all, of course, had studied their village and key people in the other Zapotec villages for years.
"Huitzilopochtli is almost as terrible as Fat Jaguar Girl," said Hunapu.
Yax raised his head at this mention of his wife, and several of the other men laughed.
"Fat Jaguar Girl beats you with a stick when she thinks you have been planting corn in the wrong field," said Hunapu. "But still you plant corn where you want."
"One Hunapu," cried Yax.
"Who told you about Fat Jaguar Girl?" "In Xibalba I watched you all. I laughed at you when you cried under Fat Jaguar Girl's stick. And you, flower-eating monkey, do you think I didn't see you pee on old Great Skull Zero's cornmeal and make them into fry cakes for him? I laughed when he ate them."
The other men also laughed, and Flower-Eating Monkey raised his head with a smile.
"You like my revenge joke?" I told of your monkey tricks to the lords of Xibalba, and they laughed until they cried. And when Huitzilopochtli's eyes were filled with tears, I jabbed him with my thumbs and popped out his eyeballs.
With this, Hunapu reached into the pouch hanging from the string around his waist and brought out the two acrylic eyeballs he had brought with him.
Now Huitzilopochtli has to have a boy lead him around Xibalba, telling him what he sees. The other lords of Xibalba set obstacles in his path and laugh when he falls down. And now I have come here to the surface of earth to make you into people.
We will build a temple and sacrifice every man of the Mexica to you, O one Hunapu, cried Yax.
Exactly the reaction he had expected.
At once he threw one of the eyeballs of Huitzilopochtli at Yax, who yelped and rubbed his shoulder where it had hit him. Hunapu had been a pretty good little league pitcher with a decent fastball.
Pick up the eyeball of Huitzilopochtli, and hear my words, dogs of Atatulca.
Yax scrabbled around in the leaf meal until he found the acrylic eye.
Why do you think the lords of Xibalba were glad, and didn't punish me when I took the eyes of Huitzilopochtli? Because he was fat from the blood of so many men. He was greedy, and the Mexica fed him on blood that should have been out planting corn. Now all the lords of Xibalba are sick of blood, and they will make Huitzilopochtli go hungry until he is thin as a young tree.
They moaned again. The fear of Huitzilopochtli ran deep. The success of the Mexica in war after war had seen to that, and to hear such terrible threats against a powerful god was a heavy burden to place upon them.
Well, they're tough little bastards, thought Hunapu, and I'll give them plenty of courage when the time comes. The lords of Xibalba have called upon their king to come from a far country. He will forbid them to drink the blood of men or women ever again, for the king of Xibalba will shed his own blood, and when they drink of his blood and eat of his flesh, they will never thirst or hunger any more.
Hunapu thought of his brother the priest and wondered what he would think of what was happening to the Christian gospel right now. In the long run, he would surely approve, but there would be some uncomfortable moments along the way.
Rise up and look at me. Pretend to be men.
They arose carefully from the forest floor and stood looking at him.
As you see me shed my blood here, so the king of Xibalba has already shed his blood for the lords of Xibalba. They will drink and never thirst again. In that day will men cease to die to feed their god. Instead they will die in the water and rise up reborn, and then eat the flesh and drink the blood of the king of Xibalba, just as the lords of Xibalba do. The king of Xibalba died in a faraway kingdom, and yet he lives again. The king of Xibalba is returning, and he will make Huitzilopochtli bow down before him, and will not let him drink of his blood or eat of his flesh until he is thin again. And that will take 1,000 years. That old pig has eaten and drunk so much.
He looked around at them, at the awe on their faces.
Of course, they were hardly taking this in, but Hunapu had worked out with Dico and Kamal the doctrine he would teach to the Zapotecs, and would repeat these ideas often until thousands, millions of people in the Caribbean basin could repeat them at will. It would prepare them for the coming of Columbus. If the others succeeded, but even if they did not, even if Hunapu was the only one of the time travelers to reach his destination, it would prepare the Zapotecs to receive Christianity as something they had long expected. They could accept it without giving up one iota of their own native religion. Christ would simply be the king of Xibalba, and if the Zapotecs believed that he bore some small but bloody wounds in a place not often depicted in Christian art, it would be a heresy that the Catholics could learn to live with, as long as the Zapotecs had the technology and the military power to stand against Europe. If the Christians could accommodate the Greek philosophers and a plethora of barbarian holidays and rituals and pretend that they had been Christian all along, they could deal with the slightly perverse spin that Hunapu was putting on the doctrine of Jesus' sacrifice.
You are wondering if I am the king of Xibalba, said Hunapu. But I am not. I am only the one who comes before to announce his coming. I am not worthy to braid a feather into his hair.
Take that one, Batista.
Here is the sign that he is coming to you. Every man of you will be taken sick, and every person in your village. This sickness will spread throughout the land, but you will not die of it, unless your heart belonged to Huitzilopochtli. You will see that even among the Mexica, there were few who truly loved that gluttonous fat god. Well, let that be the story that would travel with and explain the virulent therapeutic plague that these men were already catching from him. The carrier virus would kill no more than 1 in 10,000, making it an exceptionally safe vaccine as it left its victims with antibodies capable of fighting off smallpox, bubonic plague, cholera, measles, chickenpox, yellow fever, malaria, sleeping sickness, and as many other diseases as the medical researchers had been able to pile on back in the lost future. The carrier virus would remain as a childhood disease, reinfecting each new generation, infecting the Europeans too when they came, and eventually all of Africa and Asia and every island of the sea. Not that disease would become unknown. No one was foolish enough to think that bacterial viruses would not evolve to fill the niches left by the defeat of these old killers. But disease would not give an advantage to one side over the other in the cultural rivalries to come. There would be no smallpox-infected blankets to kill off annoyingly persistent Indi tribes. Hunapu squatted down and picked up the high-intensity light from between his feet. It was enclosed in a basket. The lords of Xibalba gave me this basket of light. It holds within it a small piece of the sun, but it only works for me. He shone the light in their eyes, temporarily blinding them, then reached one finger into a gap in the basket, pressing it on the identification plate. The light turned off. No reason to waste batteries. This basket of light would have only a limited life, even with the solar collectors around the rim, and Hunapu didn't want to waste it. Which of you will carry the gifts that the lords of Xibalba gave to one Hunapu when he came to this world to tell you of the coming of the king? Soon they were all reverently carrying bundles of equipment that Hunapu would need during the coming months. Medical supplies for pertinent healings, weapons for self-defense and for taking the courage out of enemy armies, tools, reference books stored in digital form, appropriate costumes, underwater breathing equipment, all sorts of useful little magic tricks. The journey wasn't easy. Every step caused the weight of the metal spines to tug at his skin, opening the wounds wider and causing more bleeding. Hunapu toyed with having the removal ceremony now, but decided against it. It was Yax's father, Na Yaxhal, who was headman of the village, and to cement his authority and place him in the proper relationship with Hunapu, he had to be the one to remove the spines. So Hunapu walked on slowly, step by step, hoping that the blood loss would remain minor, wishing that he had chosen a location just a little closer to the village. When they were close, Hunapu sent Yax on ahead, carrying the eyeball of Huitzilopochtli. Whatever jumble he might make of the things that Hunapu had said to him, the gist of it would be clear enough and the village would be turned out and waiting. Waiting they were. All the other men of the village, armed with spears ready to throw them. The women and children hidden in the woods. Hunapu cursed. He had chosen this village specifically because Na Yaxhal was smart and inventive. Why would Hunapu imagine that he would believe at face value his son's story of a Maya king from Xibalba? "Stop there, liar and spy!" cried Na Yaxhal. Hunapu leaned back his head and laughed as he inserted his finger into the basket of light and activated it. "Na Yaxhal, does a man who woke up with painfully loose bowels twice in the night dare to stand before one Hunapu who brings a basket of light from Xibalba?" With that he shone the light directly in Na Yaxhal's eyes. Six Kawil's daughter, Na Yaxhal's wife, cried out, "Spare my foolish husband!" "Silence, woman!" answered Na Yaxhal. "He was up twice in the night with loose bowels, and he groaned with the pain of it," she shouted. All the other women moaned with this confirmation of the stranger's secret knowledge, and the spears wavered and dipped. "Na Yaxhal, I will make you sick indeed. For 2 days your bowels will run like a fountain, but I will heal you and make you a man who serves the king of Xibalba. You will rule many villages and build ships to sail to every shore, but only if you kneel now before me. If you do not, I will cause you to fall over dead with a hole in your body that will not stop bleeding until you are dead. I won't have to shoot him, Hunapu told himself. He'll obey, and we'll become friends. But if he makes me, I can do it. I can kill him. Why does the man of Xibalba choose me for this greatness, when I am a dog? Called out Nayaxhal. It was a very promising rhetorical position for him to take. I choose you because you are the closest to human of all the dogs who bark in Zapotec, and because your wife is already a woman for 2 hours every day. There, that would reward the old bat for speaking out in Hunapu's support. Nayaxhal made up his mind, and as rapidly as his aging body, he was nearly 35, would allow, he prostrated himself. The others in the village followed suit. Where are the women of Atatulka? Come out of hiding. You and all your children, come out and see me. Among men I would be a king, but I am only the humblest servant of the king of Xibalba. Come out and see me. Let's lay the groundwork of somewhat more egalitarian treatment of women now at the beginning. Stand with your families, all of you. They milled around, but it took only a few moments. They already oriented themselves by clan and family, even when confronting an enemy, so it took little rearrangement to obey his command. Now, Nayaxhal, come forward. Take the first spine from my penis and paint the blood from it on your forehead, for you are the man who will be first king in the kingdom of Xibalba on earth, as long as you serve me, for I am the servant of the king of Xibalba. Nayaxhal came forward, pulled out the stingray spine. Hunapu did not wince because there was no pain, but he could tell how the stingray spine tugged at his skin and imagined how nasty the pain would be tonight. If I ever see Diko again, I don't want to hear her complain about anything she had to go through for the sake of our mission. Then he thought of the price Kemal intended to pay, and was ashamed. Nayaxhal painted his forehead and nose, his lips and chin, with the blood on the stingray spine. Six Kawil's daughter, the woman emerged from the midst of the leading clan of the village. Draw out the neck spine. What is it made of? Silver, she said. Paint your neck with my blood. She drew the long silver spine across her neck. You will be the mother of kings, and your strength will be in the ships of the Zapotec people, if you serve the king of Xibalba on earth and me, the servant of the king of Xibalba. I will, she murmured. "Speak loudly," Hunapu commanded. "You did not whisper when you spoke wisely of the loose bowels of your husband. The voice of a woman can be heard as loud as the voice of a man in the kingdom of Xibalba on earth." "That's about all we can do for egalitarianism right now," Hunapu said silently. "But it should be revolutionary enough as the story spreads." "Where is Yax?" cried Hunapu. The young man came forward timidly. "Will you obey your father? And when he is carried to Xibalba, will you lead this people in mercy and wisdom?" Yax prostrated himself before Hunapu. "Take out the neck spine. What is it made of?" "Gold," said Yax, when he had it out. "Paint your chest with my blood. All the gold of the world will be yours to command when you are worthy to become king, as long as you remember that it belongs to the king of Xibalba and not to you or any man. You will share it freely and fairly with all who drink the blood and eat the flesh of the king of Xibalba. That should help get the Catholic Church on the side of conciliation with the strange heretical proto-Christians when the two cultures met. If gold flowed freely to the church, but only on condition that they confessed that they were eating the flesh and drinking the blood of the king of Xibalba, the heresy should find itself well on the way to become an acceptable variant of Catholic dogma. I wonder, thought Hunapu, if I will be declared a saint. There will certainly be no lack of miracles, for a while at least.
Bakab, toolmaker, metalworker!
A thin young man came forward, and Hunapu had him withdraw the neck spine.
It is copper, Lord One Hunapu, said Bakab. Do you know copper? Can you work it better than any man?
I work it better than any man in this village, but there are surely other men in other places who work it better than I do.
You will learn to mix it with many metals.
You will make tools that no one in the world has seen. Paint my blood upon your belly."
The coppersmith did as he was told.